Okay, so I thought we would continue on with some questions and answers and then finish today with another meditation session. So, oh, she's leaping to her feet.
I promised
so
this good. Lady should get her question.
Perfect.
I'm just going to let you guys pass it around now. It was working really well.
What am I, well, my honor to be the first one. My question is, when we are practicing walking meditation, what do you think about? Do you think about your breathing, about your prayers, about what is in your surroundings? I mean, what do you concentrate on? Because there are so many things you can do. Mm-hmm. You can concentrate on your steps, on your prayers. I didn't know what I was supposed to do in terms of my mind.
Uh-huh. Well, some of the answer to that depends on which method you're choosing to do. There are some teachers who will say, forget the loving kindness, just doing walking meditation in a mindfulness context. They'll say, stay aware of your breath as you're walking. My teachers never said that. They said, forget your breath and stay aware of your steps because it will be easier. We're always hopefully aware of our surroundings and what's around us, but that's more like in the background. It's not where we're putting our energy. It doesn't mean we block it out, but we have an intention. So with anything, if you're sitting and your focus, your primary object is to be with the breath, and then there are thoughts and sounds and all these things, but not very strong ones, then the instruction is always, we'll see if it could be in the background. If you're walking, of course, there's visual stimulation, and maybe you're outside, you can feel the breeze, and you feel the sun, and these are all these things, but let's see if it could be in the background. And you're putting your energy somewhere. So in loving kindness walking, which is its own distinct kind of method, then it's not the breath and it's not the sensations, but it's really the silent repetition of the phrases that we're putting our attention on, and that's, you're aware of everything else, but that's not what you're giving your energy to. It needs to be a very light awareness, because if you try to get too intense with it, then you're going to start to block out other things, and that's not that good. So it's just having this light awareness on the repetition of the phrases, and so that's that particular practice. Yeah.
My question has to do with the impact of mindfulness and loving kindness in the larger culture. Have you seen any growth in that over the years, other than your friend who's stamping the papers in the federal government?
Well, I mean, I think there are pockets of change, you know, which are, in my mind, you know, given where I'm coming from, is extraordinary. Coming from in the sense of, you know, I talked about this last night, coming back from India in 1974 and meditation was considered such an oddball thing to do, you know. And, so to see that there's this kind of growth and acceptability and interest, you know, real enthusiasm blows my mind. It's really... it's amazing to me. For some reason, I mean, when we teach retreats, mostly they're just open. You know, occasionally they're targeted to a certain population, but mostly they're open, so who knows who's coming, you know. And then we began getting invitations to begin with in the legal profession, for some reason. Law schools, professors, lawyers. And so there's this very active movement around mindfulness and the law, and then certainly the medical profession and all of Jon Kabat-Zinn's work in the healthcare system. And You know, so that's happening. Now education, teachers and students, and so that's happening. I wouldn't, you know, I mean, I think the potential is very profound. It's really difficult world in a lot of ways, you know, run by greed, hatred, and delusion. And but I have a lot of inspiration about that possibility.
Edwin.
My question is somewhat related to that. My experience is that many people perceive that this practice is, the purpose of this practice is to change others. Mm-hmm. You know, like I do loving kindness for a difficult person because I want them to change. Mm-hmm. But from my own experience, it's only my mind that's really going to change. I would like you to speak to that if you could.
Well, it's pretty risky to invest a lot in changing others. And it's also true, like, you know, again, practicing in Burma, which is a very traditional culture in many ways, the main reason we do it is to transform ourselves and to transform how we behave. You know, so it's not just about feeling better, it's the way we behave toward others, how we speak to others, the kind of practices we do, because everything becomes a practice, right? In this world. And so that absolutely is the reason that we do it. And it's also taught in a place like Burma, that something like loving kindness is a kind of energy. It's not impossible by any means that it's going to affect somebody else, but it can't be why we do it, because the bottom line is that we need equanimity. Remember, loving kindness is like gift giving. So you can't guarantee you're going to give someone a gift and they're going to say, wow, that's like so great, thank you. Maybe they're going to like scoff at it, or maybe they're in a bad mood, or maybe they're, you know. It's like you cannot hold that expectation. So for the many people who ask, well, couldn't it be that that energetically affects somebody? You know, certainly if you ask in that very traditional setting, they'll say, yes, it might be, but you don't know. So the most important reason to do a practice like this is yourself, and the way that you'll change. And in the West, where, you know, not everybody by any means really likes that thought, you know, it sounds like superstition or something weird, it's also not necessarily even talked about. But sometimes people feel the opposite, you know, that it's too self-centered or self-preoccupied to be doing this practice just so that you can be happier. But here I come back to this notion of our own happiness being like a wellspring. And so, again, it always comes down, I think, to this analogy with generosity. If you feel inside you don't have enough, you're depleted, you have nothing of worth to contribute, then it's going to be awfully hard to give. It doesn't, you know, in this case, material generosity, it doesn't matter how much you've got by external measures. That internal sense is one of poverty. And this is why I think one can go to a country like Burma, which is very, very, very poor, and there could be so much generosity nonetheless, because there was a different internal sense. You know, in a country like Burma, for example, you don't expect to get gifts on your birthday, you expect to give gifts. So actually, Edwin and I have a very good friend who just had her 60th birthday, and I never know what day it is exactly, so he reminded me I'd missed it. So I wrote to her during lunch, and I said, I'm so sorry, I just never know what day it is. And And she wrote back and said, no problem. But I think, oh, I should have reminded her of the Burmese custom. Like, well, we're waiting for our gifts. It was your birthday. You know, that's just how it is. If it's your birthday, maybe you go to the monastery and you offer food to just as many people as you can afford to feed, and absolutely the most that you can afford to feed. You don't think, well, I'll hold off, you know, have more for myself. It's just not like that. And so there's such a different sensibility inside, and it's the same thing with loving kindness. You know, we talked a little bit about, or at least I implied something about the challenge people sometimes have with loving kindness toward themselves, but it's all a challenge in some way or for different times for each of us. Like, so many times people will say to me when we do loving kindness for a benefactor, they'll come up and they'll say something like, well, you know, I chose the Dalai Lama as my benefactor. I started doing loving kindness for him, and then I thought, wait a minute, what does he need me for? He's the Dalai Lama. You know, and I find that very interesting. First of all, how do we know that, right? For all we know, he's completely supported every single day by the prayers and well-wishing of others. And what is that idea that what I have to give is so negligible? It's so unimportant. It's so meaningless. Like, why do we go there? You know, it's that same internal state. And so doing a practice for ourselves, for our own happiness, is not just about ourselves, ever. It really is about the role happiness can play, that sense of inner abundance can play in our giving, in our sharing, in our being with others in this world. So, this is why equanimity is at the core, because otherwise it is all expectation. I sent you loving kindness all week, and you're no better.
My question is about process, I guess. You know, I was reading your book, Loving Kindness, and in there, you know, you talk about the about dropping the cold jar or whatever.
Yeah.
But you know, you talk about how that sense of like only you know you didn't get past yourself. And I've had that kind of sense too, like that I could go on forever just working on compassion towards myself. And so, but there's a lot of different steps along the way before you get to equanimity. So my question is, you know, how can you discern when is a good time to move on to the next step,
mm-hmm.
or to move backwards, or
mm-hmm.
or whatever, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, usually these days, I suggest to people that they not focus exclusively on themselves, whether with loving kindness or compassion. For whatever reason, you might feel it's wise to mostly do yourself, you know, make that offering to yourself. But I think even if it's just yourself and all beings, or yourself and one other being, it's probably a better process, because what can happen, and maybe this is part of your question, what can happen if you're only offering loving kindness to yourself is that it becomes a project. And it's like, okay, well, I can't move on to anybody else until I have fulfilled this need to really have compassion for myself. And it's too limiting. You know, then we're like watching the clock. Like, oh no, you know, I didn't make enough progress today. It's going to be forever until I can send loving kindness to anybody else. And because it's so mysterious a process, we may not see, just like that story refers to, we may not see in our formal sitting the benefits coming and the growth and the change. We may only see it in more subtle but very real ways in our life. I think it's better to be more inclusive rather than less. And in terms of when, let's say you're offering loving kindness to a difficult person, when do you go back to yourself? You're not going to make a mistake. You know, it's not like you're going to do it wrong. We go back to ourselves because sometimes we're so fretful or we're so frustrated or we're really suffering in some way. And so it's a good time to offer loving kindness to ourselves, to remember that agitation is not bad, it's not wrong, it's not terrible, it's painful. You know, and so it's a good reminder to have compassion for ourselves when we're not sitting there in bliss and bathed in brilliant white light and full of love. You know, that's not a bad state. It doesn't mean we're a bad person. It means we're hurting in some way. And so it's fine. Just, you know, keep going back to offering loving kindness for yourself. So some of it is intuitive. That's why I like to think of a daily practice, if you're doing loving kindness, as beginning with yourself. Let's say beginning with yourself, if you want to do it in that classical way. Starting with yourself and ending with all beings. And maybe that's all you do. Or maybe there is someone in the middle, or two beings in the middle, you know, depending on what's going on, that you include. Something like that.
I was in doing, I'm ending a relationship right now, a long-term relationship, and I was doing the, you know, love and compassion to this person, and I find myself almost caught in sending this person loving kindness, and yet feeling like I can't let this person go, and I feel, it almost feels like by doing loving kindness, I'm almost reattaching myself to the person. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Well, those are the kind of instances, you know, where it's, like, complicated. And so, as we say, and you might think about either alternating between loving kindness for yourself and loving kindness for the other person, or doing loving kindness for both of you together. Like, may we be happy, but it might be very different things that make you each happy. And also there is like an equanimity practice, which we'll talk about tomorrow, which is a real relinquishing of control. That would be a useful component there. It's not so much that perhaps that you're reattaching, is that you're trying to find the way to have a sense of connection, but not that other connection. And of course, that's in many ways, it's also a question of timing. And, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean severing caring, but it's different, you know, and so it's somehow infusing that loving kindness with equanimity and also some loving kindness for yourself, that it's somewhere in there, right in there, that I think the balance lies. Yeah?
Thank you for taking the question. I grew up in a Christian tradition, and I was wondering if you could compare the Christian tradition of praying for someone with a Buddhist mindfulness practice, and if people ever combine the two?
Certainly you could combine the two. I mean, I don't know, I did not grow up in a Christian tradition, you know, so I can't speak to it precisely from the inside, but there are many people in terms of mindfulness practice who from many faith traditions that who explore the technique as almost a kind of mental training apart from a belief system and appreciate the power of it and the effect of it. Even in terms of mindfulness and loving kindness practice, I tend to see them because they're just different approaches, and because my tendency is to get very confused It's usually helpful for me to say, okay, now I'm doing this, and now I'm doing that. And the strengths of mindfulness practice, the fullness of presence, the ability to let go of distraction, the ability to start again, it will carry through as skills, just not as a particular method. And I think it's fantastic that people can utilize all kinds of things, you know, in this day and age.
Sharon, over.
Hi. When I move from offering loving kindness to somebody that I know something about, even a neutral person, to offering it to all beings, it feels qualitatively different. And sometimes I label that as sentimental or unreal, or, you know, because I don't really know all the annoying qualities of those people in China. Can you comment on that?
Well, I think it's natural. You know, some people actually enjoy that more open, less specific part of the practice more. And others less, because it seems so abstract. But I think if, you know, as you do it, there's just this kind of awesome sense of, like, what if it's true that we all want to be happy? And we're so lost so much of the time, but what if we all really want to be happy? Look at how much we share. That urge, which is right. It's not something in our own case to be ashamed of or feel squeamish about. It's right to want to be happy. We just have to figure out how. As the Dalai Lama used to say, before his English got better, but I like the old way he used to say it, he said, if you're going to be selfish, be a wise selfish. It's like, if you want to be happy, figure it out. You know? And so, I just find that really incredibly awesome. Like, what if everybody really does want to be happy? And I think it's true. And not only that, look at how vulnerable we all are. You know, and this is sort of the basis of compassion. Not that we all suffer in the same measure, because we clearly don't. But we're all so vulnerable that life itself is so unsteady. It's so fleeting. It's so insecure for all of us. And we just live in this existence. And here too, we can feel very close to one another, even if we don't know one another. You know, so stylistically, people have different responses to different parts of the practice. But in a deeper sense, like, those reflections can help make that seem less abstract. I went to, it's actually a public high school in New York City, but I haven't figured out the educational system, if anybody has, because somehow you have to apply and, you know. And there were a lot of, it seemed, kind of troubled youth there. I went because the son of a friend of mine was going to school there. And she invited me. It was Mindfulness Month. So I was, like, the guest speaker. So I went in through, like, a lot of metal detectors and all this stuff. And she couldn't come at the last minute because her other child had the flu or something. So I went in by myself and went up to the office to wait, and there was a mindfulness coach there who was, I think, a banker. She was volunteering. She was coming in twice a week to teach mindfulness to the kids. So I said to her, how long do you have them sit for? Because I had, like, a whole class period. I said, how long do you have them sit for? And she said, 1 minute. And I thought, oh no, I've got a lot of time to fill. So I went into the classroom and I said, okay, I'm going to really challenge you. We're going to sit twice as long as you've ever sat before. So we sat for 2 minutes and then we went around and they all described their experience. And it was really, you know, so interesting to hear their experience of the breath and being in the moment and all of that. And then there was still time. So the mindfulness coach said about me, you know, she's this like tremendous expert in this other kind of practice. Heartfulness, which is what she called it. And so I think we should do some of that. So that really put me on the spot, because then I had to lead 2 minutes of loving kindness meditation, and I hadn't really thought through what might be an appropriate place to start and how far into the sequence should I take it, you know, so I just did it on the fly. So we started with a benefactor. I thought, okay, is there a teacher? Is there somebody that you really admire? Or it doesn't have to be a teacher. You know, who do you really admire? Who do you feel inspired by? So we started there. And then I think themselves. And then I said, is there somebody like in your class that generally you like but you're angry at right now? Just right now. So we went there. And then I thought, okay, maybe I'll do all beings, because they're all those creatures, right? Maybe they'll like that. And so I just did all beings. And that was the end of the 2 minutes. So then we went around again. And kid after kid said, I didn't like that last part. It was so abstract. You know, I liked it all before, when it was like one-on-one. I just didn't like that last part that much. And then there was a little girl, I mean, it was high school, but they seemed incredibly young to me. These other friends of mine who run this great program in New York City called the Lineage Project, bringing yoga and meditation to incarcerated youth and at-risk youth, had taken over the gym program in this school. So instead of ordinary gym, they had yoga. So this one little girl said, she was the last person to speak, she said, I've done that everybody thing already. My gym teacher made me do it. And I just love that. So blasé, I've done it everybody thing. It was like so cute. But they're, you know, they're just like us. Some people really think it's too abstract. But really, if you keep doing it, it will continue to unfold. And they're just different flavors and different experiences that happen along the way. I don't know who has...
I have a observation that you all can turn into your own question. As I pass the mic, part of my job is to look for people with questions, so I get to see all your faces. And the faces that I see are predominantly female. And it's been my experience in events like this that that's standard. And I was just talking with Les about his experience in France, that it was similar there. And so I pose this to you, especially since you got to start your center, or you chose to start your center, with two male counterparts. Where are the rest of the men? And what have we all seen? Has that changed? Is that growing? And no, not watching sports, because women like football as much as men. It's not about that. It's about something else. I don't know if it's about fear. I don't know if it's about communication ability. I'm just putting it out there, and I'll let you all play with it.
Well, I don't know the answer to that per se, but I think that even though it's predominantly true, it's not always true. And it would depend on if this were a Zen retreat, for example, that may not be true, is what I've observed. I don't know about that particular... I mean, I was there in France, and I can't actually remember. But in many cases, it's not necessarily, you know, such an imbalance. And Because I teach so much loving kindness practice, and for most of the things I teach, there is that imbalance. I wonder if that's part of it, and that just cultural conditioning around matters of the heart are trickier for men. But that's, you know, someone's work to kind of both uncover and to speak to. Okay, is there a man with a question? How about another woman?
I could pretend to be a man. You've worked with a number of spiritual mentors in different countries, and you're also a teacher yourself, so who has students. So I was wondering if you could offer your experience, your advice about the student-disciple relationship, the student-teacher relationship, and how to work skillfully together.
Mm-hmm. Well, the student-teacher relationship is different in different traditions, and so my experience has also been different in different traditions. So in the Theravada tradition of Buddhism, which is where I began and where I mostly live, and it's certainly where I live in terms of teaching. My whole teaching life is based on that tradition. The word for teacher in the Pali language is Kalyanamita, which means spiritual friend. So that's the nature of that relationship. It's a spiritual friend. And the tremendous emphasis that I got from my earliest teachers was on method, which is why I keep talking about it, because it's the method that becomes our own work that is the source of our freedom. You know, we need clarity so that we're not just running in circles, like, why can't I chase these thoughts away? Why, you know, that would be a big problem. So we need clarity about using a method, and we often need some kind of help in coming back to balance. So, remember tranquil and alert, which is like the functional part of many methods, deepening tranquility and deepening alertness, so that it's believed that it's out of that balance that the things that we want, like insight, will emerge. And that's very different than our normal, perhaps acquisitive, acquiring kind of mind, like, I need an insight by 5 o'clock. You know, what am I going to talk about at dinner? You know, the work is to deepen that balance, and with some feeling that out of the balance, the things we want will come. So teachers will often work with that sense of balance. They may not say it directly, and they may not always say it pleasantly, you know, but it's something like, you're trying too hard. You know, just let it go, you know, relax. Or, surely you could try a little harder, you know, and actually come forward and engage and really put your heart more into this process of, you know, so it's kind of around that in this tradition the teacher exists. And so I always like that model, and that's really how I live. And of course it's quite different in other traditions where there's more about that particular relationship that, you know, is more intense in a way. I mean, this is intense too, but it's very particular. And I liked it. You know, it's very independent. And that suited me. And so, but, you know, they're amazing and beautiful elements to, and complex elements to all of these teacher-student relationships. It's not something in the West we tend to necessarily understand on any level, and so it's a whole opening process of learning sort of how to be in that. There's a man with a microphone.
I'm not going to answer the previous question.
Turn the microphone on.
I'm not going to answer the previous question, but I have a question for you. I'd like to hear you talk about the relationship between meditation and sleep, and the balance between tranquility and alertness, but also how do you avoid falling asleep when you meditate?
Well, they say sleepiness and meditation can come from lots of different things, and sometimes we get really sleepy when we meditate just because we're awfully tired in general, and meditation is a way of stopping the normal momentum of our lives. So it's a little bit like, I used this example just yesterday somewhere, it's like going and going and going and going and then going on vacation and then getting sick. You know, it's like we stop for a moment and then we say, whoa, I'm overwhelmed. So sometimes meditation's like that, and we just tune into a level of fatigue that's very real in terms of how we're living, and that's interesting. Sometimes we get very sleepy in meditation just because of that dynamic between tranquility and alertness. And it's not a bad state, but it's a state that's out of balance, like the tranquility side of things is deepening, but there's not enough just sheer energy in our system to match. And so the first place we go is this state that's known as sinking mind. I call it the ooze. You're just kind of oozing a lot. It's pleasant, you know, but it's not very sharp. And again, it's not bad, it's just out of balance. And so if it deepens that imbalance, then we fall asleep. And so the antidote is really to pick up energy. Not lose the tranquility, but pick up energy. And sometimes it's very mechanical. Open your eyes. Sit up straighter. If you're with the breath, if that's the kind of practice you're doing, then sometimes we add mental noting, like repeating in, out. In, out, very quietly, but still, it's enough of a kind of energy boost to be using the word that sometimes it can just clear the clouds. It's actually also interesting in terms of methodology. That state of sinking mind can sometimes be more obvious in doing loving kindness than in being with the breath, for example, because with the breath, you might ooze along for a good long time before you realize that you're really sluggish. Whereas what happens in the loving kindness, because it's verbal, it's more active, is that the phrases tend to get garbled when you're in that state. So, for example, in Burma, sometimes I would be sitting there and I'd hear myself repeat, may you be filled with suffering, may you be filled with... No! May you be free of suffering! And there are all kinds of stories about that. Maybe I'll talk about it more tomorrow. You know, so it's just a sign that we need some energy. There's a quality called right aim, which is very energizing. Let's say back to the breath for a second. Although it could be anything, but I'll use the breath as an example. Sometimes we have this feeling like we want to be with this breath and the next 50. And it's like spreading our energy too much. Whereas if we say, just this one breath, just now, then it picks up our energy. You know, so there are lots of ways that we work with it. But it's all about that particular balance or imbalance. And there's some list, of course, because there's so many lists about ways of dealing with sleepiness, and it includes all the things I just mentioned. It also includes pull your earlobes. I don't know why. But maybe the acupuncturist in the room can tell us why. And then the last thing on the list is take a nap, which I always appreciated, you know, that it's on the list, and it's not the first thing on the list. So we try this, and we try that, and we try that. there may be a man we need to take a nap. Okay, let's sit together for these last few minutes we have together today. And if you're doing loving kindness practice, why don't you begin with yourself? And those who helped you be here, see who comes to mind and offer loving kindness to them. Maybe they're taking care of things at home, or they told you about their meditation practice long ago. And then one another. And all beings everywhere. Thank you. May you be happy and such things. And see if sometime tonight you can do a practice session. It could be sitting, it could be walking, it could be lying down. It could be 5 minutes, it could be 20 minutes. But see if you can dedicate just some period to simply breathing or simply doing loving kindness, no matter what. Okay? See you tomorrow.